Welcome to the Global Governance Podcast, where we explore the future of governance. Each episode will look at a different global issue and how governance plays a key role in its solution. From climate change to gender equality, from corruption to peace and security, we invite experts to explore a thought-provoking game of what if and why not, positing a world in much closer international cooperation.
Dr. Michael Penn is a professor of psychology at Franklin and Marshall College in the United States and a trained clinical psychologist. His research interests and publications explore trauma, applying psychological research and theory to human rights, interpreting psychology and philosophy, gender equality, and the human spirit. Professor Penn is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and served the UN Leaders Program for over a decade. He has supported initiatives targeting gender equality and peace in Brazil, Great Britain, and Greenland. He has written, co-written, and edited 4 books and numerous academic papers and chapters. From 1998 to 2000, Professor Penn was in Switzerland designing the UN-funded Education for Peace project that assisted Bosnian Herzegovinian children post-genocide. He is the recipient of several honors for teaching and community service and distinguished scholarship. Dr. Penn, Michael, if I may, thank you very much for agreeing to participate in this podcast. We are really honored to have you with us. One of your main interests is human rights, the basis of which, I guess, is concerned with acknowledging the inherent worth of all people. You have written that human rights can only be protected when there are conditions that allow people to develop their inherent capacities and have their dignity respected. I found this really very appealing. Human rights throughout history, as you know more than anybody, have been at the basis of many different religious traditions. Traces of the concept can in fact be found in ancient documents, and of course more recently, in recent centuries, I mean the constitutions of not only the United States, but those of many other countries throughout the planet. And of course, they were also explicitly incorporated in the UN Charter adopted in 1945 and the subsequent adoption of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948. So to get started, Michael, in your view, what's the next stage in the unfoldment of this process and in achieving these rights for all people?
Thank you, Augusto. How wonderful. What a great honor it is to join you in this program. I should begin by pointing out that, of course, I come to this question as a psychologist rather than as a human rights lawyer or a human rights theorist. And so many of my ideas around the development and protection of human rights has to do with the human person, has to do with the development and the well-being of the human person. In fact, I assume that if life can be said to have a purpose, that purpose would appear to be development. We live in a small part of the universe that makes development of living things possible. And so when I think of human rights, I think about the creation of the conditions that are required for the development of human beings, and therefore for the protection of the natural world. In other words, the natural world depends upon the development of human beings, and human rights seeks to secure those conditions that are required for the healthy and safe development of human beings wherever in the world they live. That's the approach to the discourse on human rights that I generally take. I think about development as really a process of transforming capacities into capabilities. I think about capacities as potentialities, which under the right conditions become capabilities. So for example, if I have an acorn and I want to see the acorn develop into an oak tree, I have to satisfy the acorn's needs. It has to be buried a certain distance from the surface of the earth. It has to get sufficient amounts of water and light and time. And gradually, the capacities of the acorn become revealed in the capabilities of the oak tree. And so when I think about human development, I think about the coming into being of potentialities that are animating the human mind, that are animating the human spirit, and that these potentialities are present in human beings all over the world of whatever culture or background or race or religion. And the purpose of government is to create the conditions where these capacities can be realized. And one of the ways that we have learned to do this is to incarnate in our practices and in our policies principles of human rights. So that's a short answer to the question about the connection between human rights and development. And I think we'll return to that question in a few minutes. But I wanted to say a little bit about the horizon of human rights discourse. And I think that, discourse on human virtues have largely been neglected by modern human rights theorists because virtues are generally thought to be private matters that animate the lives of individuals and are thus outside of the scope of human rights theory and practice. So rather than focusing on virtues, human rights theorists tend to speak of things like universal values. The universal values to which states commit themselves, as you know, serve to adumbrate the rights-related aspirations that also serve to define the limits of human behavior, of the behavior, rather, of state actors in their relations to individuals, cultures, and communities. For example, states that do not respect the rights of their citizens can be charged with violations of ethical norms that are incarnated in things like the Convention on the Rights of the Child, the Geneva Convention, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. They can be charged with even serious crimes like crimes against humanity. That was a really important development, holding the state responsible for its behavior with respect to its citizens. But I think that the next horizon of human rights has to do with holding citizens more responsible by cultivating in them the capacities that are necessary for citizens to become protagonists and active agents in the protection of human rights. And I think that this requires the cultivation of human consciousness, the cultivation of human virtues, the cultivation of moral sensibilities. And I think that more and more attention perhaps needs to be paid to this part of the movement in human rights so that the common citizen can become an active agent in the protection of human rights because of the kind of person that they are. They bring to human relationships the qualities, the characteristics, the noble aspirations that render it possible for human beings to be in right relationship to one another and in right relationship to the natural world.
I was thinking when I heard you talk about sort of holding states accountable for the human rights commitments which they have made in various important documents, I was thinking about the current situation in Ukraine and the struggles for freedom in Iran. I'm sure like everybody else, you have been following the story that has evolved over the last few months following the death of that young woman, Mahsa Amini, in police custody in September of 2022. And then, thinking about the incidence of poverty, malnutrition, inequality in the world, the sort of looming environmental disasters that one sees in the horizon due to climate change, one cannot avoid sometimes, I'm not going to say feeling depressed. Perhaps I can be a little bit more diplomatic and say feeling a bit alarmed, that despite the progress that we have made since 1948 in gaining recognition for the importance of human rights for well-being and so on, much remains to be done. So my question to you is, have we stagnated in our quest for human rights? Especially I'm thinking, with respect to the treatment of ethnic and religious minorities and women. I spent a good part of the last decade at the World Bank, and there we had developed a very fascinating database which identified gender discriminations embedded in the laws of 190 countries. And the picture that emerges out of that you know, it's really quite appalling. I mean, it's just amazing the number of countries that find ways, you know, to turn women into second-class citizens virtually in every continent of the world. What do you think?
Augusto, I think that's a great question, but my view is that, you know, humanity's development does not appear to take place in a kind of smooth and easy upward movement. It appears to take place in great leaps, which are often followed by periods of relative stagnation and sometimes even a momentary step backward. Achievements in the pursuit of human rights evoke counter-reactions from individuals and institutions that have a vested interest in the denial of rights. And so I'm not at all surprised that the movement towards the incarnation of human rights around the world has suffered serious setbacks periodically here and there. And they are suffering very serious setbacks right now all over the world, including in the country where I live, in the United States. You know, you may remember that in 1972, Miles Eldridge and Stephen Jay Gould, who were paleontologists, found that the fossil record, the physical fossil record, showed that living creatures, living beings, did not tend to develop in a kind of a smooth, gradual process that Charles Darwin had imagined. That rather, the fossil record had indicated that there are relatively long periods of stability or of stasis, and then suddenly living creatures develop new forms or new capabilities. And they were interested in how to explain this very, very rapid leap in capacity development, followed by very, very long periods of relative stability and stasis. Also, in the more sort of social and human realm, the more psychological realm, the more philosophical realm, you may know that Carl Jaspers coined the term the axial age. And his idea was that if we look across history, we see that at critical moments in the life of humanity, there have been profound changes, almost as though humanity had acquired in different stages of development a new mind. And his first indication of this, the first indication of this that he identified, was a period in which on the earth there lived a bunch of philosophers in different parts of the world. For example, there was the Buddha in India, there was Confucius and Lao Tzu in China, there was Zoroaster in Persia, there was Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle in Greece, there were the prophets of Israel in Mesopotamia. What they did was they fertilized the human mind with new concepts, with new visions, with new aspirations, with new ways to think about life on Earth. And great civilizations came into being as a consequence of these new ideas. I think that the ideas that incarnate the human rights movement are of that sort. They are of such profound significance that I think that they will have a long and beautiful and prosperous future, but it won't happen instantly. It will be gradually a process of us coming to understand, for example, what we said in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, what we were hoping for. And I think that that gradually our aspirations come in line with our behavior, with the conduct of nation states. But it's not something that happens magically. It requires processes that are sometimes quite arduous and difficult. And we have to, I think, maintain our confidence and our faith in humanity's ability to achieve human rights, notwithstanding the terrible records of violations of human rights all over the world.
I want to shift gears a little bit. Thank you, Michael, for that. It was very, very insightful. You wrote an article with Aditi Malik, and I'm just going to quote a sentence from it. You said that attention must now be focused upon that which lies at the heart of human purpose and motivation, the human spirit. Nothing short of the awakening of the human spirit can create a desire for true social change and instill in people the confidence that such change is possible. I find this fascinating, this notion of the human spirit. And so I want to ask you, for the benefit of our listeners, Tell us what you mean when you refer to the human spirit. What is the relationship between the existence of a human spirit and the quest for human rights?
I think of the human spirit as a kind of power. You know, there are different kinds of power in the world. In the natural sciences, we know of the existence of the powers of nature. The powers of nature include powers like the strong nuclear force, the weak nuclear force, electromagnetic energy, and gravity. These are the basic powers or the basic forces of nature. But there are also powers of consciousness. And when I think about the powers of consciousness, I think about the human spirit. What are these powers? The powers of consciousness include, for example, the capacity to know, which gives us the power to acquire knowledge of the world and of ourselves, or knowledge of truths about the world. So, for example, E equals MC squared would be a truth that we have acquired about the natural world. So the human spirit gives us the capability or gives us the power to extract knowledge and understanding of the kind of world that we're living in, gives us knowledge and understanding of our own selves, and gives us knowledge of the principles and laws that govern the operation of the natural world. This is a uniquely human power. There are, of course, different kinds of truths. For example, there are existential truths, truths that I have that are private to myself. For example, if I say to you, Augusto, I'm hungry, and I really believe it, that's a truth about myself that is subjective. But there are also objective forms of truth. AX squared plus B equals C equals plus BX plus C equals zero. That's a kind of logical or mathematical truth that we all learned in high school. So there are different kinds of truths that human beings have access through the powers of the human spirit. And so one of the powers of the human spirit is the capacity to know things. A second capacity is the capacity to love. And I think that the capacity to love takes as its object beauty, the beauty of an idea, the beauty of nature, the beauty of a way of life. I think that the human spirit has a natural attraction to beauty. We want to make beautiful things. We want to live beautiful lives when we are healthy. Architecture, dance, poetry, theater, various forms of philosophy, even of mathematics, can appear to us beautiful. And so the human spirit is interested in beauty. It's interested in cultivating it. It's interested in being around it. And when human beings are developing well, they become, in a sense, a reflection of beauty. Their behavior, their speech, their attitudes, their values are indications or signs of beauty in the world. And then the third power of the human spirit is the capacity to will, which takes as its object that which is perceived to be good. And we develop all kinds of institutions in order to protect that which is perceived to be good. So religious systems around the world are interested in promoting and protecting values. Every society has committed itself to the cultivation of values. We have committed ourselves to the cultivation of values because we think that by cultivating values, we can best protect that which is most excellent or that which is most noble in us. So when we think about the human spirit, we think about a set of capacities which, when cultivated, gives rise to certain kinds of human beings that then, in turn, give rise to certain kinds of civilizations, certain kinds of social orders. And so the human rights movement has largely been interested, I believe, in creating the conditions that are necessary for the development, for the happiness, for the well-being of the human spirit. You can remember that when the trial at Jerusalem took place following the Second World War, Adolf Eichmann was charged with crimes against humanity. And this was a very, very significant charge because it was one of the first times that jurists had defined humanity as a single species that needed to be protected. And that this protection required legal backing. In other words, the laws had to protect the human species from unnecessary suffering, unnecessary violence, and unnecessary death and destruction. And so when they charged Adolf Eichmann with crimes against humanity, they were I think, taking a very, very great leap and thinking about the human community as one organic system, as one family that needed to protect itself from itself and from some of its darker nature. And so in the last 25 years or so, I've been trying to say something about what might be meant by humanity. What might we mean when we claim to protect humanity? And so my discourse, my writings on the human spirit, try to give a rational account of the nature of the human spirit that would be compatible with what we know in the natural sciences, but would also comport with what philosophers and what some of the world's religions have had to say about its nature and about its needs.
Thank you, Michael. One can tell as I listen to you that you are a very good teacher, having spent a good part of your career, you know, in contact with students and trying to simplify, abstract, sometimes complex concepts for them in a way that is appealing and accessible. So my next question is about young people. And you have often emphasized in your own work the need for to include them in the discussions and in the creation of a culture of respect for human rights. And I can certainly endorse this idea. I find it very, very appealing because, in fact, young people are the, you know, tomorrow's leaders, and they will inherit the consequences of our failures to address some of the global problems that I mentioned earlier on. You also make a very interesting argument for the inclusion of the concept of altruism in school curricula. What's your definition of altruism, and why is it so important for this to be a central part of the education of our children?
Thank you. Michael Haslip, who is a professor here in the United States as well, and I collaborated on a project a few years ago where we tried to encourage educators around the world to think seriously about the cultivation of an orientation towards altruism amongst their students from kindergarten all the way through high school. We thought of altruism as being characterized by the tendency to act in the service of others without a hidden motive to benefit oneself. It thus implies a kind of selfless service that is animated by the spirit of kindness and benevolence. Altruism, in fact, we thought, is the highest form of social competence, as it promotes the common good and at the same time redounds to the development of the child who is manifesting altruism. So altruism is good for the child who is manifesting it and also good for the community that is receiving the child's altruistic behavior. The cultivation of altruism leads to the development of a life of service, we think. And a life of service is manifested in a coherent and balanced approach to serving the well-being of people and of the planet. It's embodied in everyday efforts that transcend even part-time civic engagement. Indeed, we think of it as a kind of a solidarity that we feel with others, and this solidarity inspires us to want to be of benefit to others, inspires us to want to be of service to others. And as we serve others, we find in our hearts that it is a joy, it is a pleasure, it is a delight to be of service, to be of benefit to others. And so we become agents of social change even in our childhood, even in our early youth. And so this attitude of service is gradually taken into our workplace and gradually taken into larger spheres of influence. I think that without enlarging our concern, enlarging our compassion, it will be unlikely that we will achieve, for example, the human rights aspirations or the human rights goals that are articulated in so many of the documents that come out of the United Nations and other agencies that are concerned with the protection of human rights. And this is why we began to write about altruism as part of the curriculum animating institutions of learning around the world. Allow me to say just one more word about it. You know, over history, over time, and over cultures, there have been basically two systems of knowledge and learning. One of these systems I call the academic scholastic tradition. And the academic scholastic tradition is concerned with acquiring knowledge of the natural world. And so the sciences, the technologies that we have been able to create have been the result or the harvest or the fruit of this academic scholastic tradition of learning. And it's a very, very powerful tradition. But there is another tradition of learning called the wisdom enlightenment tradition. And the wisdom enlightenment tradition has concerned itself with knowledge and mastery of the self. It has to do with acquiring the kinds of qualities of consciousness, qualities of behavior that render the individual an asset to the community rather than a liability. And the wisdom enlightenment tradition has been really, really sort of integral to to the development of ancient civilizations. I think that we need really to think about reintegrating the wisdom enlightenment tradition into schooling around the world. And this is one of the goals that had inspired us to write about altruism and its value in a series of papers that were recently published.
I'm sure you're familiar with the writings of the philosopher William Hatcher. He views spirituality as a process of developing our innate capacities, a concept that you have talked about just now. Capacities which he says are universal, because every human being has them, is endowed with them by the mere act of being born. And then he introduces the concept of authenticity, you know, in human relationships. And he says that it is related to the presence of selflessness and altruism, which I think is very much sort of in harmony with what you have just said about altruism. Assuming that many in our audience are adults and are past the stage of schooling and therefore unlikely to benefit retrospectively, you know, from greater emphasis on altruism in the schools, how can people continue to facilitate their sort of own moral and altruistic growth? In other words, how can one, you know, later in life, you know, nevertheless, you know, sort of enter this path of spirituality, of developing one's innate capacities?
I'm so glad you brought to mind the great philosopher and mathematician William Hatcher. William Hatcher was a dear friend of mine. I met him when I was in Switzerland, and really, really fell in love with his work, with his thinking, with his humanity, with his self, with his person. And so I'm so glad that you brought him to mind. He was a dear friend. You may know that Hatcher had argued that the full development or flourishing of a human life requires first an understanding of the nature of value, and then the application of that understanding in our behavior. And he articulated three kinds of value. One kind of value he described as extrinsic value. Extrinsic value is socially constructed value. So for example, if I have a $5 bill, the bill derives its value from a community that has conferred upon the $5 bill symbolic value. You cannot develop a complex society unless you can confer symbolic value. So the ability to confer symbolic value was a very important development in human, in the cultivation of human civilization. But that kind of value is simply a tool for the cultivation of a second kind of value, which he called intrinsic value. Intrinsic value is related to what a living thing can do or become. So one of the examples that I like to use is the example of the sun shining in the sky 93 million miles from the Earth. The sun is of value irrespective of my beliefs about it. When I'm born, I don't know the value of the sun. The value of the sun is, of course, reflected in the fact that it is the source of life and warmth in the biosphere. All the things that exist in the natural world depend upon the sun for its existence. When a child is born, she does not know that. She has to gradually become acquainted with the nature of the natural world. She has to become acquainted with the things of the natural world and how they relate. And so when we become knowledgeable, when we begin to understand the natural world, we begin to appreciate the value of the things that animate the natural world. Hatcher suggested that the highest expression of value in the natural world is the human person, and that the cultivation and the development of the human person is really the goal of all human relationships. And we can evaluate the quality of our own development by assessing the degree to which our presence in relationships facilitates the development and well-being of other human beings. And we can say that we need to make improvements when we realize that our way of relating to other human beings, and indeed perhaps our way of relating to the natural world, causes unnecessary suffering, unnecessary difficulties, unnecessary hardships. And so Hatcher was interested in what he called moral authenticity. And he said that the great moral challenge of every human being is the challenge of entering into right relationship with other living creatures. And so when we are striving to achieve the capacity for moral authenticity, we are developing ourselves. And when we neglect that aspect of our development, we become unnecessarily cruel and unnecessarily judgmental and unnecessarily sometimes even vicious in our behavior, in our attitudes. And these modes of thinking are related to human rights because we bring even these ways of functioning into systems of governance, into complex and large organizations. We are behaving badly. We are thinking in ways that are cruel and egotistical and arrogant and psychologically violent, that then also shows itself in physical forms of violence, physical forms of manipulation and of corruption and of greed, all of the things that make for the destruction of a social order.
You know, your comments just now brought back very nice memories of William Hatcher. I spent several years in Moscow in the 1990s, and so did he. And he spoke a number of times at our home in Moscow. And I always remember with admiration the ability of the Russian audience to listen to Bill literally for 2 hours, with translation included, you know, and to be captivated by his arguments, you know.
Absolutely, yes.
Many of those meetings with Hatcher were really quite memorable. In the spirit of William Hatcher, let me pose my next question, which pertains to another person for which I have great admiration, which is the Indian economist Amartya Sen, who wrote once that, I quote, human rights are entitlements that require correlated duties, he said. And then, sort of thinking in somewhat sort of mathematical terms, he says, if a person A has a right to some X, then there has to be some agency, call it B, that has the duty to provide A with X. If no such duty is recognized, then the alleged rights cannot but be hollow, right? And, you know, it seems to me that this, not only is it very, 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 you know, obviously true, but it sort of poses a tremendous challenge for taking human rights to be rights at all, if, in fact, nobody has the responsibility to deliver those rights to the people who are supposed to enjoy them and have them, right? You know, we have countries that have signed on to the UN Charter and to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. I'm thinking of Iran in particular. And today, of course, you know, they discriminate against the Baha'i community. They discriminate against young women and girls and women more generally. So in the absence of this agency can deliver that can deliver these rights, you know, Sen says that human rights are heartwarming sentiments, right? That sounds a bit harsh, but it does bring home this point, right? That we do need to think a little bit about accountability and delivering these rights, you know, to people. Tell me a little bit about how you see this issue. I admit it, it's perhaps more to do with the implementation of sort of the broad principles that we have come to accept collectively as a human family. Hmm.
There's a wonderful book that I would recommend to you if you haven't already read it. It's called Human Rights Beyond the Liberal Vision. And it's by Judith Blau and Alberto Mancada, who are senior leaders of Sociologos Sin Fronteras, Sociologists Without Borders. In this book, they offer a kind of an analysis of the way, for example, that American liberalism as embodied in the country's ethos and its social institutions, its approach to politics and economics, tends to foster a worldview that is incompatible with the promotion of humanity's collective interests. And so they try to interrogate, they try to lay out an explanation for how American liberalism, just as an example, neoliberalism, just as an example, stands in the way of promoting human rights. And they point out that by liberalism, they don't mean, you know, the usual way of thinking about liberalism, which is focused on, you know, those who tend to favor government spending for domestic programs or apt to support progressive taxes or oppose war. That's not what they mean by liberalism. What they mean is liberalism in its historical and comparative sense, namely a political and philosophical commitment to individualism in the spheres of politics, economics, and society. Such a commitment, or what they call an ideology, powerfully binds together two spheres of freedom, they suggest, economic freedoms and political freedoms, in ways that threaten and sometimes undermine social cohesion. They point out that while Americans are usually quite committed to humanitarian justice, which takes as its form and its focus extreme violations of human rights, such as crimes against humanity or genocide, they are less inclined to even think about the role that they might play in protecting and advancing ordinary human rights that are critical, for example, for food security or employment or the ability to make a living wage or access to a decent education or the right to live free of equality-defying oppressive ideologies, or freedom from exposure to health-compromising environmental waste, and so forth. And so they are concerned with the ways that human rights become blocked, the realization of human rights become blocked, not because of the imposition of tyrannical forces, but because of ideological commitments that prevent us from serving the needs of the generality of humankind, because we don't think about governments as having that responsibility. And so they are suggesting that if human rights are going to advance further in the 21st century, we will have to come to grips with the fact that many political ideologies that are on the face of them quite benevolent, like American democracy, may indeed need to rethink the ways that its philosophy prevents the realization of human rights by failing to address the legitimate needs of human beings if they are going to develop their potentiality. And by needs, they mean a form of assistance that's required for the development of human capabilities. So I think that to double back on Sen's important observation, I think that their claim is we must think of governments as instruments for securing and protecting human rights, yes, but also the will of the people must be oriented around the protection and development of human rights. And the people must be invited to enter into the discourse on human rights. And they must be helped to understand how their philosophical, their political, their economic views might in fact be a barrier, an obstacle to achieving human rights for all around the world.
Michael, this has been a most interesting, insightful, substantive conversation. I really thank you very much. And one can tell that you have given a great deal of thought to this whole subject. But in my last question, I want to come to you in your role as teacher. You have done some very interesting work on hope and hopelessness. And I think that we are at a time in history when many people, especially young people, are struggling to find hope for the future. The rise of climate anxiety and the myriad of complex problems that young people are facing can easily become overwhelming. And you see more and more evidence of this, actually. You probably know this much better than I, because you are a clinical psychologist. How can people avoid becoming stuck in hopelessness and instead feel that they are contributing to building up a sustainable future, one that gives us confidence that their children will not be born into some kind of dystopian world of climate crisis, a kind of a post-nuclear holocaust, or a late-stage materialistic nightmare that has sapped people's zest for life, you know, their happiness at being alive? Please, as your concluding answer and your concluding words, direct some words of encouragement to the young people in our very large audience.
You know, one of my very favorite writers was the writer and humanitarian Victor Hugo. And you may remember that when Victor Hugo was alive, he said, "There is nothing so powerful as an idea whose time has come. Some ideas are so powerful that their implications cannot be neglected. They cannot be denied. The truth, for example, that humanity is one interdependent family, one species living together on this small blue and green planet that is moving through illimitable space at about 60,000 miles per hour, and that we are growing into our maturity after billions of years of evolution. The truth that our consciousness is evolving and that our understanding is being enlarged every day, and that the technical means necessary to live in unity as one family, as one species, are being developed every day. These truths, I think, should give us confidence. We should have patience with one another. Outside of my window, at this very minute, there is a tree that is bursting into full bloom after winter. You know, had we seen this tree in the wintertime, it would be hard to believe that in just a few months, it was going to burst into life again. It was going to bring forth in a few years apples or oranges or pears. And so that's the miracle of life, I think. It unfolds in cycles. It is characterized by periods of winter, periods of difficulty, periods of hardship. But these periods are followed by spring. So we have to, I think, continue to do our best to contribute to the development of our civilization, trusting that our efforts will, in fact, be capable of contributing in meaningful ways. I'd like to close actually with a quotation that I encountered a few days ago that I really love. And it goes like this. It says, "The darkness of this gloomy night," and this quotation was written by a Persian gentleman who had spent about 50 years in prison as a political exile and prisoner. He wrote, "The darkness of this gloomy night shall pass away. Again, the sun of reality will dawn from the horizon of the hearts. Have patience, wait, but do not sit idle. Work while you are waiting. Smile while you are wearied with monotony. Be firm while everything around you is being shaken. Be joyous while the ugly face of despair grins at you. Speak aloud while the malevolent forces of the netherworld try to crush your mind. Be valiant and courageous while men all around you are cringing with fear and cowardice. Do not yield to the overwhelming power of tyranny and despotism. Serve the cause of democracy and freedom. Continue your journey to the end. The bright day is coming. The nucleus of the new race is forming. The harbinger of the new ideals of international justice is appearing. The trees of hope will become verdant. The copper scorn and derision will be transmuted into the gold of honor and praise. The arid desert of ignorance will be transformed into the luxuriant garden of knowledge. The threatening clouds shall be dispelled, and the stars of faith and charity will again twinkle in the clear heaven of human consciousness."
Thank you for listening to the Global Governance Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with friends and family. To learn more, please visit globalgovernanceforum.org and join the conversation.